You're listening to The Point. Penikis Island is part of the Elizabeth Island chain that stretches south and west from Cape Cod. The island has a rich and varied history, but a through line of its past is education and scientific research. Today, we talk about the history of the island and its role in field research and education. Joining us is Kimberly Ulmer. She's executive director of the Penikis Island School. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Pamela Poloni is curator of vascular plants for the MBL Huey Herbarium. Hi, Pamela.
MBL Huey Library Herbarium. It's in the
library. Oh, it's Library Herbarium. Okay, that makes more sense, doesn't it? And then Bob Bordereau is the Massachusetts State Botanist. Welcome back, Bob. Good to see you.
Thank you. Good to see you.
So, Kimberly, for those who are not familiar with Penikis, give us a brief history of the island and the different ways it's been used for the past 150 years.
Oh, my gosh. Brief is a challenge
hard,
with Penikis. But I'll start in this sort of inaugural year of these botanical surveys. So that was the summer of 1873 and 1874 when Louis Agassiz had a school out there called the Anderson School for Natural History. And one of his students, David Starr Jordan, who went on to eventually be the first president of Stanford, did this first botanical survey. So it's a very short chapter in Penikis' history, just those two summers, but it's a sort of remarkably impactful time for Penikis. Alumni from that Anderson School went on to found the Marine Biological Laboratory here in Woods Hole. They also went on to found the Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory on Long Island. And as I just mentioned, David Starr Jordan was at Stanford, so he helped found their Hopkins Marine Station. So to this day, all three of those institutions, the MBL, Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory, and Stanford, are still, you know, well-regarded, well-renowned scientific institutions. And so what Agassiz did out there on Penikis was he really sort of launched a whole era of studying nature in nature versus indoors wearing a suit, just reading books. So that was a short chapter in Penikis' history, but it's sort of where what we're talking about, where it began.
Yeah. Pamela, listeners might be surprised to learn that the MBL and Woods Hole Oceanographic have this herbarium. So first, explain what a herbarium is and how long Huey and MBL has this been in existence with the organization.
Well, originally it was at MBL. And it's a collection that is pressed plants, dried pressed plants. A lot of people think they want to come see growing plants, but dried pressed plants. And the first collection that we have four of the five collections, and now are getting some of the sixth collection that's going on that Bob can tell you about. Mm-hmm. And the first one from David Starr Jordan are algae specimens that we have.
Wow. Yeah. And it's like people think when you used to, you know, press the rose from your prom, like in the book, that's what they look like. But it's much a much better process, right? the way you've got them mounted, it's like artwork, right? And it's
yes,
got where it is, where you find it, all of that, the dates. And how does the herbarium support current biological and oceanographic research?
Just recently, we've had several people come that are looking at stable isotope analysis, comparing specimens from different years, different collections, by taking minute samples.
Mm. Bob, if you were a botanist back in the 1870s, would Penikis Island have caught your attention as an interesting place to conduct field research?
All islands are at least somewhat interesting, no matter how rich they are in species or lack thereof, because of the theory of island biogeography, which came about in the 60s. It's always interesting to see, you know, how these islands compare to the nearest mainland populations of plants. So, it would have been interesting. And we know from reading historical accounts that the island was, at one time, 620 years ago, potentially largely forested with red cedar. So there's been a lot of changes over time. And there's a lot of plant species, even whole plant families, that are kind of missing from the island. But that gives the opportunity for other plant species groups to create cover on the ground and create new species assemblies or assemblages of new plant communities. I would interesting. It's hard to, you know, it's hard to find a place where a botanist doesn't find it.
So true. So human activities, of course, can shape the botanical landscape more than natural processes, right? So talk about the ways human presence on Penikis can be seen in the historical botanical data.
It's hard to know the direct effect, although there were a lot of introductions from gardens that I think took place. Various groups over time, you know, when they were staying out there, planted different garden species, and then they would have spread into the wild there. And what's more, my own in the past, my own division of fisheries and wildlife apparently had a large effect on it, not in a really positive way. In the old days, the thinking of wildlife biologists, I guess you would have called them, wildlife managers, from, say, the 1920s to the 1960s, they would plant a lot of really, in many cases, non-native species that they thought would aid some form of wildlife. These would be things like multiflora rose or, you know, different species, say, from Asia, autumn olive, for example, that provide a lot of fruit, but are now considered horrendously invasive and highly negative in their effect. So there's been that effect. And of course, there was probably a couple hundred years of sheep grazing on the island. So
anyone who has visited the islands familiar with the gulls who use the island as a rookery, do you know if that's always been the case? And if not, have the presence of the gulls changed the botany of the island?
There are a lot of terns and gulls now on the island. Tern populations have increased. And that's through recent management of the Division of Fisheries and Wildlife and other people. Before last year, the 2024 survey, there were three consecutive years of prescribed fire in the spring on the island. And that was done primarily to improve the habitat for the nesting terns and gulls. And so that's definitely changed the vegetation, but not directly through the terns and gulls. The waterfowl that do affect the flora more than anything else are geese, Canada geese. Everybody knows are wildly overpopulated nowadays and are very busily nibbling on vegetation night and day.
Bob, as you look back at the historical botanical record of Penikis, what are some of the plants that used to be on the island that are now gone, and what are some of the new plant species that are there?
We haven't gotten really far in our analysis of that. There was a section in the probably the best survey of the flora of the island was done with and Pam is the second author on that. So Pam was out there with Dick Bacchus. A lot of people in Woods Hole probably remember him, knew him. Richard Bacchus is his legal name. So they did their most extensive survey, and so Pam might be in a little better place.
Yeah, go ahead, Pam.
Well,
tell, yeah.
I would like to say that in 1999, we had permission from Mass Division of Fisheries and Wildlife, that Bob just mentioned he works for, and we visited Penikis monthly from April through November. Dr. Bacchus reported in OE. The group was a botany club, and that he kind of invited to help. And he, in our second newsletter, he said the great advantage that the 1999 survey had over earlier surveys was the presence of the Penikis Island School. The survey parties lived at the school during their work, and were carried to and from the island by the school's boat, at that time the Harold M. Hill. Those who stayed there are much indebted to the school for this great hospitality. This is what Dick Bacchus said. What he didn't report was that the two or three of us doing the plant survey slept in the bunks of boys that the boat had taken home for the weekend. We enjoyed meals with and the company of the staff, and Dick always hoped that the few boys who didn't get to go home might become interested in what we were doing. People who listen regularly to CAI will recognize the voice of sea cook and fisherman Dave Mash, who was often our host. One time Dave caught a big striped bass and cooked it for our dinner.
That's a great story, Pam. And I just want to add that Kimberly is very involved with the current Penike School, and we're greatly interested in her for schlepping us out there to the island 3 times last year to do survey work.
Yeah, we'll get back to the survey work in a second. I think there are people who go, what is the school still there? What's going on? So go ahead and tell us what's going on.
Yeah, there's a lot of educating of the public that I'm hoping to do. So first, what is Penikese Island? As we mentioned, it's this tiny 75-acre island 1 mile north of Cuttyhunk. It's at the end of this Elizabeth Island chain. What is the Penikese Island School? So the school was founded in 1973 with a very different mission than we currently have. It was founded to be a private rehabilitation school for juvenile delinquent boys. Very different than our current mission, which is to do science and nature and environmental educational programs out there. So that shift happened to our new mission in 2019. And when I learned about this really cool long-term data set of these botanical surveys, and I realized there'd been a survey in 1999, I came on board to the Penikese School in 2021 as the new director, knowing that 2024 we were going to be due for another one of these surveys. And I vowed to myself and the board that this data set will not die on my watch. And I am not a botanist, and so I knew I wasn't going to be doing the survey. And so I was thrilled that when I reached out to the state, to Bob, that he said, oh yeah,
we're... Oh, no worries.
Yeah, he generally, people are curious about Penikese and want to go. And so Bob assured me there would be no problem getting botanists to come out to Penikese and do the survey. I'm just thrilled that this island has this really wonderful, interesting, totally crazy history that you couldn't write it. I mean, it was a leper colony for a few years, but this science history is a wonderful tie-in to our new mission of using Penikese as a field site where it's the teaching venue and it's the teaching resource.
Right. So, Bob, how does the state manage plant and wildlife on the island, if at all?
I think it's primarily through prescribed fire, but there also is a crew out there, potentially even today as we speak, doing some herbicide treatment of invasive species. I don't know exactly what species they're working on, but that's also thought to be a factor in improving the nesting habitat for terns, which is, and gulls, but both of those are really high priority. Some of the tern species that nest there are federally listed, federally endangered. So it's really important to keep that nesting habitat in its prime. So those are the two types of management that we do out there.
And the terns, like, this is the time you maybe don't want to be out there because they're dive bombing you, get anywhere near their nest.
Yeah, I mean, there are, you know, 3,000 or so gulls and 3,000 or so terns. And I just, for the people that are not birders, these are not birds that nest in trees like your backyard birds. Right. These birds are ground nesting birds, and they like this grassland habitat. And so the state, having Penikese be a wildlife sanctuary for these birds, the state is trying to keep it a grassland habitat. And so, Bob, when I went out there, it looked like the poplar had taken a hit from the herbicide. So these are these young trees that were coming up. And so, again, the state's trying to keep it a grassland and deter a forest from growing.
Makes sense.
I might add that for many years, Ian Nisbet, who is a tern expert, tern researcher, had been taking a couple of dogs out there to chase the gulls off.
Oh, my.
So the terns would have a chance to come and nest.
Oh, boy.
That was about when we were
That's
there.
Not happening anymore.
No dogs allowed, that's for sure.
No, but he would take them out for a couple of days, just one, because the gulls would arrive before the terns.
Right. We're talking about the history of Penikese Island and specifically the legacy of botanical surveys that date back 150 years. We'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about Penikese Island and the history of botanical field research and education taking place there. With us is Kimberly Omer, Executive Director of Penikese Island School, Pamela Poloni, Curator of Vascular Plants for the MBL Huey Library Herbarium, and Bob Wernerell, who is the Massachusetts State Botanist. Pam, tell us a little bit about botanical surveys on the island. How did they work?
What I remember about our going out there was every day we would collect voucher specimens. Those are specimens that represented plants that were there. And every time we went, we would find more. But we would collect in a certain area, and then after a couple of hours, we would press all the plants and label them. And Dick Backus always did it by giving it a number. And so he always knew which plant was which. And then I remember that one time in August, Ted Hendrickson came out with us, and we walked by a plant that we had walked by many times. It was a big bush of Smilax rotundifolia, catbriar or bullbriar. It was one plant, big. And we'd never included it in our list.
We missed it. Oh, yeah.
Usually we tried to find flowering and fruiting plants so we could really make sure we could identify them.
Bob, are there particular collection protocols that ensure the data you collect will be useful when compared to the historical data? You know, for example, time of year, amount of time spent collecting?
Yeah, I don't know if it's a correction or not, but these aren't annual surveys. Pam and
25 years.
Yeah, yes. Every 25 years. So that has a fancy name to it in Latin, but can't think of what that is now. Quadricentennial, something like yeah. that. It might be most informative just to speak about the slightly different approach we're taking because of modern technology. We are compiling a list on iNaturalist in part. We can visually collect, and we've expanded it a little bit beyond plants. So we're also doing some insect collection on iNaturalist. And that's done with kind of a hashtag system. So every observation you post on the platform, iNaturalist, you hashtag it Penikese 2024 or something. And then we can search on that hashtag and see the list. And that helps a little bit because we can get other experts to weigh in on the identification of the species. And they can be, as far away as Russia, if they're experts in that taxa. So we've been doing that. And then we use a Google spreadsheet, an online spreadsheet that multiple editors can do online to compare. And we should mention Vicky Lefebvre here, a key member of Pam's group, the Botanical Club of Cape Cod and the Islands. She did a massive amount of work putting on the spreadsheet all the previous plants that had been. So it's on the left-hand column, and then you get many more columns with each plant species that was found in each of these six surveys. That was hugely helpful. So we really owe her a big debt to getting that started. And the other thing I'll mention is something similar in experientially to what Pam would have encountered. And it was really neat for our group. We went out in October, I believe, when we stayed overnight. It was either the September or October. And by then there's very little daylight. And at night we're working by kerosene lamp. And I have a great picture where there's like five botanists huddled around a microscope and botany books spread on the table, all to the light of kerosene lamps, trying to figure out the exact identification of the species. And you look at that picture and it just takes you back 100 years or more to what it would have been like doing these surveys then. So that was a really neat experience. And yeah. I want to thank Kimberly and her group for allowing us to come out there and transporting us.
So Bob, you're mentioning the internet and digital tools and, you know, the changes in how things are collected. Is the historical data from the island available digitally?
In papers in Rhodora, which are...
Yes, Rhodora is the publication of the New England Botanical Club, mm-hmm. now New England Botanical Society. And our survey was published there in 2000. And we have four of the first five collections in Woods Hole at the herbarium. And then the 1973 collection is out at Smith College. And the last one that Bob and Kimberly and Vicki are working on, we now have 20 specimens that Peter Grima and others collected last year already in the database.
Yeah, I just want to note that not only are the publications available, you know, with the words telling you about these plants, but digital images of these plant specimens, they've all been...
also available,
They're available, and they're stunning.
Yeah, they are. I was saying you could hang these on your wall like artwork. They're beautiful. Bob, are there any rare or endangered plant species found on the island?
There are. Both of those. There's a really nice one, Angelica lucida, which is a seashore. Angelica is actually one of the few plants that shares the common name, and the scientific name is the same. Angelica's very well known in Europe, used medicinally and in gastronomy. But this is a species that hugs our seashore, and it's quite rare, and it's one we're quite concerned about because of the sea level rise. These plants tend to live within 30 feet of the actual shore, so they become more and more rare over time. And then there's a few other species there as well that reside close to the seashore.
That was my next question, considering climate change is impacting our region, what changes do you hypothesize we might see in the botany of Penakees?
Well, I just want to note that the first survey included six species noted on what's called Gull Island, which now is a nearby sandbar full of a population of gray seals. But David Starr Jordan noted six different species out there. So I don't think that's just due to sea level. I'm sure there's erosion factored in there, but it's a wonderful way to illustrate that, you know, since 1873, what had some plants is now just a sandbar with some bathing seals hanging out.
Wow. Yes.
Kimberly, you talked about the current mission of Penakees. Describe what makes Penakees such a unique and special place for these different kinds of educational programs.
Sure. I think, similar to islands being intriguing to Bob as a botanist, I think islands are intriguing for many people for many reasons. They just have this sort of mystique about them because they are solitary. You have to get there by boat. And when you're there, you're just naturally, geographically isolated. And so I think there's a lot of intrigue of going to a tiny island. And because it's a wildlife sanctuary, nobody lives there. And we, the school, have a few buildings. And so when we bring school trips there just for the day, it feels like, they're king of their own mini island, and they're running around. And there's also no ticks really on Penakees, which if you live on...
Wait a minute.
Cape
no
Cod
ticks?
Or Martha's Vineyard. Yeah.
Wow.
I can't say no because we did have two Lone Star ticks during our summer camp last year, but we did have campers from Martha's Vineyard, so I'm hoping they might have just been hitchhikers,
right.
The ticks.
Wow. Do you have to worry about folks just kind of, in their own boats popping up on the island?
So the Penakees Island School, part of our... sort of agreement with the state is that we provide sort of a presence there during nesting season. So if we don't have an overnight program, then we have to have some sort of caretaker that can interface with visitors and remind them, hey, this is a wildlife sanctuary. There's rules, no dogs, no camping, no fires, no fireworks, no alcohol, no smoking.
And I imagine you have to be very careful of the habitat, too,
yeah,
right?
Stay on the marked trails. Yeah. Don't go to these sort of the nesting sites that are off limits during nesting season. So that's a service that we provide for the state. And I think my understanding is that was sort of a bargaining point in 1973 when they were trying to get the school established, was that, hey, we can sort of chase off the cuddy-hunk rabble-rousers that are that are coming here to drink beer and have a campfire with their dog that are disturbing the birds. We can, remind
them
that.
We can help you out there,
yeah.
All right, so Kimberly, you have an event planned at MBL next week. Tell us about that.
So Wednesday, July 16th, I'm going to have a big celebration of this 150 years of botanical surveys. And the idea is just to sort of showcase this history, showcase the ties between Penakees and the MBL. And I also view it a little bit as our reintroduction under our new mission to educate people as to who we are and what we're doing now. The art, the sort of 2D photographs are already there. So this is the Meg's Room, which is in Swope, which is that sort of 1970s dormitory dining hall building, for those of you that are familiar with the MBL. But on July 16th, we'll have food and drink, and I'll invariably say a few words, trying to keep it brief. But if you are unable to make it on July 16th, you're welcome to go see this works on display Memorial Day to Labor Day.
I was going to say, how long? Till Labor Day. Awesome. So, okay, we're going to post links with more information about the event, Penicuik Island School, and the MBL Hui Herbarium Library at our website, capeandislands.org. Kimberly Umer, Executive Director of Penicuik Island School. Pamela Poloni, Curator of Vascular Plants for the MBL Hui Library Herbarium. And Bob Wernerell, Massachusetts State Botanist. Thanks so much for taking time to be with us. Appreciate it. Thanks for sharing this with us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.